Okay, let's get rolling again. Any questions before I move on?
Well, just another quick one.
Mm-hmm.
So you were mentioning how they like to tell stories, talk mm-hmm. about their exploits.
Yeah.
Is it common to embellish a lot? Or,
Oh, yeah.
Like make things like a lot more fantastic than they
Because part of this lifestyle is maintaining a rep, a facade of being tough and capable and sharp and so on. And, you know, one level of that is I need to actually follow through on being tough enough so that, you know, people aren't eager to get in a fight with me because I fight pretty decent, etc. But if I can, you know, do some good PR and impress people more than is reality-based, that's to my advantage. So a lot of these people have had plenty of practice embellishing their exploits and so on so as to sound more impressive than they actually are.
And they'll do that in therapy.
Oh, yeah. And everywhere else in life, too. You know, they don't just wear black leather because it's cool. They wear black leather because it creates an image. It intimidates people. You know, back before everybody had tattoos, they get tattoos because that made them look tough. It intimidated people and so on. You know, and actually I can think of a number of people, you know, I know who, you know, you're going to, you know, cross the street, you know, because they look tough, they look dangerous. You know, some of them are actually pussycats, but they're creating this image. You know, back when I was, before I went to grad school, I worked as an orderly in an emergency room for a while. And one day, a little before Christmas, you know, I was there on duty, and this black motorcycle gang came in all in leather and chains and looking, you know, it turned out they were there to deliver toys to the kids up on the But the entire staff cringed and moved to the far side of the room before we realized what was going on. One quick thing I want to mention before I lose track of it is in the clinical lore, you'll hear people talk about how there are criminal sociopaths, by which they mean people with antisocial personality disorder who get caught and locked up, and the idea that there are successful sociopaths out there who are sharp and capable and get away with this and profit thereby. And depending on people's preferences, they'll point to certain professions or to point to certain political figures, etc. And obviously, it's a little challenging to test empirically the question as to whether there are people out there who have antisocial personality disorder and get away with it because they don't get caught, because how do we catch up with them to hand them questionnaires and so on? If, you know, by definition, if we spot them, then they haven't been so successful that we can't spot them. But my take on it, and DSM's take, is that if somebody truly has antisocial personality disorder, they're not good enough about thinking ahead about consequences and making good choices to succeed in the long run. There's no shortage of people who may have some antisocial features, may have some antisocial tendencies, and they profit thereby. And A, there's no shortage of crooks, and many of them don't have antisocial personality disorder. There's also no shortage of people who have some antisocial features but don't meet full criteria. And so, yes, there are some people who lie and cheat and steal and profit thereby, at least in the short run. The odds are good they don't actually have antisocial personality disorder. They're just crooks. And some crooks are better at it than others.
And I think that's what I was going to say. I worked in a prison for several years in mental health, and there really were, I saw very few full criteria antisocial personality mm-hmm. disordered people. There, I met some really good ones and some really great examples, but overall, people had, most of those guys had traits, and most of them just weren't very smart and got caught.
Well, and actually, that's a good point. The best predictor of ending up in prison is being dumb. Mm-hmm. Lots of people. Who obeys the law completely all the time?
Nobody.
You know, personally, on my way over here today, I did not obey the speed limit at each and every moment. Now, I also chose a speed that I thought was likely to not get noticed by the people out there catching speeders. You know, and a big part of the prison population is just people who didn't have the sense not to do stupid stuff, which is unfortunate, but that's a different topic. So, how the heck are we going to be helpful to these folks? Well, in terms of strategy, we got some beliefs and assumptions that we're going to probably want to eventually chip away at, but we can't start there. And the big challenge, first of all, is how do we develop a collaborative relationship, including how do we develop goals for therapy that are meaningful enough for the client, for them to get behind and to motivate some persistent effort for change, and that we're also willing to sign on for, too. Now, if I approach therapy with the idea that our goal is to get the client to be good, that's not something they're going to sign on to. If their goal is to be be more efficient at raping and pillaging, that's not something I'm going to sign on to. How the heck do you motivate an antisocial individual to put in some persistent effort towards a goal? Well, that's one of the big challenges in effective treatment. And what motivates antisocial individuals? How about self-interest? If I can help the client see how it's to their advantage to follow through on the stuff that I've got in mind, that works pretty decent as a source of motivation for change. And since we're dealing with a population that's not real good at thinking ahead about consequences of actions, etc., I'm going to need, at least at the beginning, to be focusing on some fairly concrete, immediate, short-term payoffs to following through on what I've got in mind. Good concrete example. Back when I was first in the area working out in Lorraine, a 13-year-old kid got referred to me, dragged in, kicking and screaming against her will by parents and school authorities. The stance she took with me was, you can't make me do anything I don't damn well want to do, which seemed to replicate her stance with her parents and school authorities. How do I develop a collaborative relationship? Well, a good starting point is, okay, I understand you think it's a dumb idea to be here, you don't want to be here. Given that you're stuck being here, do you see any way this can be helpful to you? Is there anything you'd like to get out of this? Sometimes people see ways they, and sometimes it turns out to be easy. Nah, waste of time, no way I can be helpful to her. And so I need to look at it from her point of view. How would it be to her advantage to play along with me? And part of that depends on, what do I know about the situation? Oh, she's due in juvenile court tomorrow for a decision on whether she's incorrigible or not. And if she's judged incorrigible, at that point it meant 6 months in juvie. And so I said to her, gee, my understanding is you're due in juvenile court tomorrow, for this judgment on whether you're incorrigible or not. What's your understanding of what happens if you're judged incorrigible? Oh, you go to juvie. What have you heard about juvie? Does juvie sound like a place you'd like to spend 6 months? And you can sort of see the light come on as she started registering it. Do you have an image of how you're going to approach court tomorrow? Oh, that judge can't make me do anything I don't damn well want to. Oh, that sounds like roughly the way you're approaching me. I didn't actually say that part out loud. Okay, so that's one option. Suppose you go into court tomorrow and prove to the judge that he can't make you do anything you don't damn well want to do. Do you have an image of how that's going to turn out? What's the judge's take on that likely to be? And you can see the bulb glow brighter as you, oh, wait a minute, that gets me judged incorrigible and shipped off to juvie. And so, okay, so one thing we could conceivably do today is spend a little time thinking through how you want to approach court tomorrow. One option is to go with your usual approach, see about proving to the judge he can't make you do anything you don't damn well want to do, and it sounds like your best estimate is that that's going to result in you spending 6 months in juvie. Suppose you would prefer not to spend 6 months in juvie. What other options are there? Well, I'm not brown-nosing anybody. Okay, so it sounds like brown-nosing is one option. You don't want to do that. Proving to the judge that he can't push you around is another option. you don't like the results that's likely to produce. What other options are there? And, you know, we did some, you know, thinking it through, considering alternatives, and she came up with a game plan that she didn't see as brown nosing, that made sense to her, that she thought was likely to work. And then she tried it the next day in court, and by George, she kept her butt out of juvie. Hmm. You know, now, A, you know, my stock has gone up considerably. Oh, I can be useful after all. But poof, we've accomplished that goal. We don't have any, you know, that doesn't provide any more motivation. So the next round is, okay, well, what else would you like to accomplish? Gee, from what you've told me, it sounds like parents and teachers are on your back a lot of the time. Now, you like having them on your back? Suppose we could work together to figure out how to play your cards so as to get them off your back. Is that something you'd be interested in? Hey, what conduct disorder kid doesn't like that one? And if you stop and think about, what's she going to need to do to get parents and teachers off her back? She's going to need to think ahead about the consequences of her actions. She's going to need to, you know, make choices about what to say and do. She's going to need to develop the skills it takes to inhibit those impulses and choose her words rather than just saying the first thing that comes to mind. She's going to need to, you know, look realistically at the rules and choose which to go along with and which to break, etc. In other words, she's going to need to do all the things it takes to no longer be a conduct disordered kid if what she wants to end up doing is getting parents and teachers off her back. And you notice, you know, I needed to do more of the heavy lifting than usual. I need to look at it from her point of view and think through, how is it to her benefit to play along with what I've got in mind? How do I help her see that? Because this is stuff that she's not yet good at. Hopefully, over the course of therapy, we'll polish up those skills and get to the point where she's a lot better at thinking ahead about consequences and making good choices. And one piece of trivia to file away in doing that, you know, it's real natural to put our energy into focusing on the bad consequences that'll happen if the person does bad stuff. And there's some research that suggests that antisocial individuals are actually less influenced by bad consequences than the average person. And we may well get more mileage out of focusing on the payoffs of pro-social behavior than focusing on the risk of antisocial behavior. Also, this is a population that underestimates the likelihood of getting caught and underestimates the consequences, so it's harder to generate motivation from focusing on the bad consequences if you do get caught. You know, it generally works. I'm going to certainly acknowledge, you know, risks and likely consequences on the negative side, but I'm going to put more of my effort into identifying likely payoffs to more promising behavior. And particularly at the beginning, focusing on fairly immediate, fairly concrete consequences. With everybody, immediate consequences are more motivating than delayed, far-off, uncertain consequences. You know, why do people quit smoking? Well, what the research shows is, in general, people don't quit smoking because of the risk of getting cancer in 20 years. Getting cancer is a serious consequence, but it's far off and it's uncertain. Everybody knows somebody who smoked like a chimney for years and never got cancer. You know, people are much more likely to quit smoking because they don't like having yellow teeth, because they don't like getting short of breath, because they don't want to be a bad example for their kids, because they don't want their wife to keep nagging them. You know, those are much less serious consequences, but they're more immediate and more certain. And so they end up generating more motivation. And on the motivation for change front, one approach which works real well and is very compatible with this is motivational interviewing, which was initially developed after tons of research as a way of generating motivation for change with substance abuse, and plenty of these folks have substance abuse issues, But it actually turns out to be a pretty powerful approach for generating motivation for change for anything. And actually, this is a good point to go to the video and look at a good demonstration. Therapist here is, what's his name, Miller, who developed motivational interviewing. And this is a one-time demo session with a client that he doesn't have any history with and doesn't know a heck of a lot about. The client we don't know much about. I don't know if he has antisocial personality disorder or not. He certainly has, you know, enough antisocial features that he could have antisocial personality disorder. He also may well not. But this is actually a pretty good demonstration of how things go with the antisocial population. Come on, machine.
What is it that brings you here today? Well, actually, I'm doing a favor for a friend of mine. And he told me about a thing you guys are doing, so I figured I'd participate in it. And he told me you were basically an addiction counselor, and he thought I might be an interesting subject.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay. Well, tell me about where you are now with the addictions that you've been...
What
do you want in particular? What, are you in recovery now? Or?
No.
Okay. All right. So what are the drugs, or what is it you're talking about?
Well... Honestly, cigarettes.
Okay.
That's my biggest.
Okay.
Alcohol to a degree, but I think I had more of a problem with that 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to have gone down to a degree, and probably simply because of the environment.
So that's kind of settled down.
Well, not all that much.
And, you know, one of the things I noticed so far is... we're getting a fair amount of bullshit here already. Why are they? Oh, I'm here as a favor to a friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He thought this might be interesting. You know, it may well be that a friend told him about it, but no, that's not why you show up to do a videotape session about dealing with substance abuse. And at this point, we don't know. He's saying, oh, you know, drinking used to be the problem. It's gone down some. I don't know if that's accurate or not. You know, I'm sure you know the traditional approach in the substance abuse field is to be real confronted. Now, this is bullshit. You know, you got to quit denying or you'll never get into recovery, etc. And if you use that approach, what happens? Well, initially, people push back. They push back pretty vigorously. You know, if you keep at it for long enough, maybe you pound through their defenses. Or maybe you drive them away. And if I do pound through their defenses, this has somebody at a point where they're less capable, it's going to be harder to get them to follow through on doing what needs to be done. And also, it can evaporate pretty easily. You know, when you think about doing an intervention where you get all the person's friends and relatives to come in and confront them about their problem, you know, one of the hallmarks of that approach is you got to have a slot lined up for them so you can take them immediately and directly into treatment. Because their motivation for change is going to be gone in the morning, which is a real drawback to that approach to generating motivation for change. You know, one of the ideas behind motivational interviewing is rather than confronting stuff head on, you know, roll with the defenses, basically use a more skillful approach. And so he's saying, you know, the guy says, oh, my drinking's gone down. You know, Miller's response is, oh, this sounds like it's not much of a problem. And the guy's response is, well, actually, it is a problem. that trying to be collaborative and work with the person doesn't mean being a wimp, doesn't mean letting them get away with shit. It actually, you know, certainly for me, it works a whole lot better than the confrontive approach. You know, Ellis can get away with a confrontive approach. Man, that's not the person I am.
You know, it's gone down because we get too old to do this. If that makes any sense. If I can't keep up with it anymore. I don't think I can. I really don't think I can. And then cigarettes are still a real addiction for you. I don't do that. It was. In the past, I've done cocaine. I've even done crack cocaine. I've heard that's one of the most addictive drugs around, quite frankly. From my own personal experience, I don't find it addictive at all.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's different for different people.
Yeah, yeah.
But for you, it's tobacco and alcohol.
Yeah, yeah.
And coffee.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to get that specific.
How far do I go?
I didn't want to go. I don't know. I got the lady that's completely addicted to chips.
More bullshit.
How might you like things to be different? I guess that's a good place to start. Well, basically, you know, I don't see that.
And asking how the person would like things to be different is a real good starting point. You know, in the motivational interviewing framework, the first round is helping the person see how the status quo is not to their advantage, helping them to see the drawbacks to their current behavior. You know, with my 13-year-old, you know, does she like having parents and teachers on her back all the time? No. You know, round two is asking questions that get the person taking it more seriously. It usually boils down to, if you keep doing this, is it going to get better and better or worse and worse? You know, round three is, if you could make some changes, how would that be to your benefit? How would you come out ahead? And round four is there reason to believe that if you give it a serious try, you've got a decent chance of succeeding? And the idea is that if by, you know, asking questions using guided discovery, we can get to the point where the person registers, what I'm doing currently is not to my advantage. And if I keep it up, things are going to just get worse. But there are some changes I could make that I would profit by. I would come out ahead. And if I give it a serious try, I've got a decent chance of succeeding at that. Then we're likely to have somebody with significant motivation for change and reasonably persistent motivation for change. It's not going to evaporate by morning. Now, with the antisocial population, since they're not good thinking ahead about consequences and so on, we may well need to revisit this every few sessions to refresh it. But it produces more consistent motivation for change, and it's a good foundation for collaborating. You know, as long as we can identify some goals to work towards that I'm willing to get on board with, too.
All that committed to making is all that different, because I'm not seeing that much harmful benefit. I was told that you're not able to slow it down, it's progressive, and you get worse and worse and worse and worse, and that just doesn't seem to be the case with me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I think that certain things in my lifestyle just preclude me not using.
Right?
And that, and smoking has become a problem because I'm starting to play soccer. Okay?
So you can't breathe?
But so I can't breathe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The kids are younger and younger.
Yep.
Half my age, twice my size. I'm having a problem.
And you're noticing.
Okay, yeah. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, I mean, the message that you shouldn't use it all is like somebody out there telling you that, but that doesn't fit your experience. I don't know. We'll use it all. What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Oh, I guess maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you were saying people telling you that you can't use it, shouldn't use it, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they probably have before. You know, I've been through, I just really didn't know nothing bothers you.
Nothing at all.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry about that. I thought at least they feel, here's what happened. I got a DUI a while back. It was after 93, and I had one prior to that, 85. And I went through some counseling with mandatory state driven. Basically, you go through counseling, after you successfully complete it, you rehab.
Right.
After you rehab, and then you get your driving privileges back.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is that I had some bad experiences. Not bad experiences with counselors, but I found them to be not less than professional, but just very rigid in their approach.
Okay. And that didn't work for you. That didn't fit.
It didn't fit at the time. At the time, I don't think I was really all that committed to quitting. And then I was, but yet another time. But the other time was because I was earning $40 an hour, and I was working 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. So guess what?
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to be able to quit. You see,
mm-hmm.
That's what those counselors told me.
Mm-hmm.
That was very strange that I was. So I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that I would have a negative attitude about, you know, some of the things I've been through as far as the state program is concerned. I don't know how I could explain it in part if you have any Well, I think I've got it. But it sounds like your experience doesn't match what you were being told.
No.
That they're telling you this is how you are, and you look at yourself and say,
no. That's not necessarily true. And, you know, then there, too, you were supposed to say, well, I'm an alcoholic, and I've always had a problem, so I have to quit, and I can never drink again, this, that, and everything else. And you had to really say that.
Right.
Or else you weren't fitting in the role they wanted you to play,
right,
without fitting in the role. If they wanted you to play, you could not get your license back. So, you know, I played the game, basically, and I went to AA, and I also found that just a little bit on the, you know, they didn't work for me as proper stick of therapy.
Okay.
They see me and they say, wow, how profound. Uh-huh. Man, you guys are deep. You know?
All right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, seriously, I mean, went there, and these guys were, didn't do anything all day.
Sure,
but they didn't drink that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd rather, let's say, bed twigs, maybe build a patio, maybe program our days, and then drink. Instead of just not drinking and do nothing else. I found that, you know, certain things, certain aspects about it, I like, but I think you have to have a deep-seated religious belief for it to work for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you, you want to have an active life in a way. Not drinking is not doing something. It's doing nothing.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
So for you, the question is, what am I going to be doing? How do I spend my time?
Yeah. Yeah, that's
my doctor.
That's good. Yeah, and actually, I was, you know, thinking myself, the way I can best quit smoking is not by quitting smoking, but playing soccer 3 times a week.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Now I'm going for something, okay?
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, I'm having a problem breathing. Okay? So guess what? Just go on and quit smoking. You're not going to say, I'm going to quit smoking. You know. But to me, that doesn't work for me. If that works. You know,
it might even less than not work. I mean, it might make it
less likely. I think it's less likely. Yeah, now, you know, I quit smoking before for about 4 months. Did it go out on you? And,
yeah.
I went down and see my brother, and boom, right back to
yeah.
And, you know, same thing with drinking. I mean, I think I was actually more, how should I say, I seem to have more craving when I was going through conflict.
Right.
And then when I wasn't. Okay, so it's like, okay, reverse the fact. Guys, you really are helping me a lot, you know. And
so I wonder if it isn't being told you can't, or like being in prison in a certain way.
Yeah, and it could be just a maturity of my part. You know, it's being told that I can't do something, I'm going to do something.
Right.
You know, maybe what they should say is, you better drink every day. You know, and I want you to drink a 54 before noon time. You know, then they get it off. Screw you guys. I don't know. Maybe there's something about my personality like that. So I, you know, what should I say? One size doesn't fit all.
Yeah.
Okay. One size doesn't fit all.
And be what matters is having something that you're going toward.
Right.
Not something you run away from.
Right. Right.
And one of the things is soccer.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, tennis. How about backpacking? You know, how about just waking up clear-headed?
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, don't you think that's true? Pleasurable? Thank you. Because you're getting
up in the morning and being able to think and,
you know, clearly. I'm telling you what works right now. I, you know, sometimes I don't want to drink 4 or 5 6 days. If I smoke 2 packs of cigarettes, I wake up with a hangover. I thought it was the booze, but
without the booze.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
It's carbon monoxide. You got no oxygen in your system, so. I guess that's my real problem right now, isn't it?
I'm going to tell you, it's something you're not that worried about, alcohol, really.
No, it's bad, but it's not yet bad.
It's not causing you problems.
No, it'll cause anyone problems.
How so?
Wow. And you notice, this has him telling us the ways in which smoking is a problem for him, the ways in which drinking is a problem for him. You know, we'll get to whether cocaine or crack are currently a problem for him or not. It turns out those are history and aren't currently a problem. And if we can maneuver things so that the client is telling us how their current behavior is a problem, that works a lot better than us trying to tell them how their behavior is a problem. Because these are people who are really good at saying, no, that's bullshit.
That's hard.
Yeah. Yeah, this is not easy work. And one thing to notice is it's real easy to lose track of what you're shooting for.
Yeah.
You know, because it gets convoluted, stuff goes around and around, they come up with new bullshit that I have to stop and think about, and does this make sense? And, you know, I need to spot the parts of what they're saying that I can get on board with. You know, this idea of I need to be working towards something, not just trying to avoid bad stuff. Hey, that's a good concept. I can work with that. And but there's all the bullshit mixed in that I've even not gotten aboard with. So this is another one where I find it's really useful to have written down on my clipboard before the start of the session what I've got in mind, what points I'm hoping to get to today. You know, because then I can look back at it periodically and keep straight. You know, and then when we come up with the agenda, I write down the agenda. And in addition to writing down the specific automatic thoughts and so on I might want to refer back to, if I have a good idea, I write it down so that I don't lose track of it. And that makes it much easier to stay on task and not get distracted and diverted by all that's going on. Questions, comments, reactions? Yeah.
Good question. You know the movie, The Good Will Hunting? The kid, Matt Damon at that time, does he have, in that movie, was that he had entered personality disorder?
I haven't actually seen that movie, so I don't know if anybody who's seen the movie has an opinion.
I would say yes.
But certainly the hallmarks are, you know, impulsivity, irritability, being lousy at thinking ahead about consequences, being lousy at grasping how the other person's going to react to stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And certainly, there's no shortage of these folks who show up in movies. They make very interesting characters.
You should see that movie.
Yeah.
Because the therapist sounds like you.
Well, yeah. Both Barb and I tend to see movies that aren't too much like work.
Yes.
Sitting at home, we've got a couple of the Despicable Me spin-offs, the little shorts about the Minions. Okay, that's what we do when we're off duty. Which actually is relevant to antisocial personality disorder, just smaller and more yellow. And so, in terms of strategy, you know, I'm going to, you know, focus on using self-interest as a source of motivation for change, and just I'm going to use the standard motivational interviewing approach with just a bit more of an emphasis on self-interest. And we got this in the handouts at the bottom of page 4. And what I'm going to want to do early on in therapy is try to take a problem-solving approach. Take specific, concrete problem situations. And in addition to finding out what the situation was, what led up to it, what the thoughts and the feelings are, you know, how is this a problem for the client, and what can they do about it? Good concrete example, Rex's initial complaint was all the impairment that was resulting from his chronic medical problem. You know, basically, you know, he would wake up in the morning feeling like shit, he would roll over, go back to sleep, he'd wake up a few hours later feeling like shit, and he'd end up doing very little, feeling lousy physically, getting more and more depressed as the day goes by. And this was his, you know, top issue to work on. Great, you know, we have an agenda for the day. This is basically it on the agenda. And so first of all, I need to understand the status quo. You know, okay, you know, pick a good concrete example of a time when this is a problem for you. Pick one that you remember reasonably clearly. You know, would this morning be a good hour? Yesterday morning? I think he picked yesterday morning. And I had him fill me in on the situation. You know, so far that he wakes up feeling like shit. The thoughts that run through his head is, I feel like shit. He rolls over, goes back to sleep, etc. The scenario I gave you. And then in my great wisdom, I can repeat back to him, so from what you're telling me, this is what happens. And, you know, sounds like, you know, if tomorrow morning you wake up feeling lousy, if we just go with what comes naturally, you'll roll over, go back to bed for a couple hours. When you wake up a few hours later, how are you going to feel? Oh, you're going to feel worse physically. You know, when you eventually do get out of bed, how are you going to feel? You know, how are you going to end up spending your time? How are you going to end up feeling? So it sounds like if you want a day where you accomplish very little, end up feeling depressed and feeling lousy physically, Your usual approach works fine for doing that. You know, any idea, suppose you wanted things to turn out differently. Any ideas as to what you could do to get different results? And he, of course, has no idea whatsoever. Well, let's think in terms of concrete examples. Can you think of a time where you woke up feeling like shit and for some reason or other got out of bed anyway, rather than rolling over and going back to sleep? Well, yeah, last week there was a day where he woke up feeling like shit, but there was somebody important who he needed to talk to, and so he couldn't roll over and go back to sleep. Okay, so then as he got out of bed, how did he feel? Both physically, what emotions was he experiencing, what thoughts were running through his head. And in the short run, he felt worse. It hurt more. And he had an assortment of thoughts about how much it hurt and how much this sucked. And then he got into the shower and took a hot shower. And he felt a little better physically. And then he had some breakfast and felt a little bit better physically. And then he got out of the house off to this meeting with an unnamed important person. And, you know, A, he felt better physically than on days when he stayed in bed. He felt better emotionally by the end of the day than the days when he stayed in bed. Not only did he get to the meeting he was supposed to get to, which was not optional, but he got a number of other things done that day. And so then in my great wisdom, I can say, so from what you're telling me, if you wake up feeling like shit and roll over and go back to sleep, you're in less pain while you're asleep. But you wake up a few hours later and you feel at least as bad, maybe a little worse. And you eventually drag yourself out of bed and mope around the apartment and end up both feeling lousy physically and getting more and more depressed. On at least this one occasion, you dragged yourself out of bed and felt worse in the short run. Then you took a shower and felt a little better. You had some breakfast, felt a little better. Got out of the house, felt a little better. And, after you'd been up for an hour or so, how did you feel? How did that compare with the way you felt when you first got up? How did that compare with the way you felt on the days when you rolled over and went back to sleep? You know, from what you're telling me, you accomplished a number of things on the day when you dragged your butt out of bed. How much did you accomplish on the day when you rolled over and went back to sleep? You know, think about, you know, the evening, the day you dragged yourself out of bed. How did you feel then in terms of your mood, etc.? How does that compare with the way you felt on the day when, days when you rolled over and went back to sleep? Gee, sounds like, from what you're saying, like if I want to feel like shit, rolling over and going back to sleep is a good way to have a day where I end up feeling like shit. If I would prefer to feel better, dragging myself out of bed seems like a good move. What do you think? Does that make any sense? You know, suppose you did want to drag your butt out of bed. How would you go about that? How could you get yourself out of bed, you know, when you wake up feeling lousy, you know? You're not going to have an important meeting first thing on most days. Can you think of any other ways to get yourself out of bed? You know, and he was sort of drawing a blank. You know, suppose you woke up feeling like shit and were able to say to yourself, I feel like shit. I know from first-hand experience, if I roll over and go back to sleep, I feel better for a little while, but then I end up feeling even worse, not accomplishing anything, getting more and more depressed. And I know from first-hand experience, if I drag my butt out of bed, it feels worse for a little while. Then I take a good hot shower, I have some breakfast, and I feel better than if I stayed in bed. And if I get out of the house and do stuff, I end up having a much better day than the days when I roll over and go back to bed. Suppose you could remind yourself of that. When you wake up feeling like shit, what effect do you think that would have? You thought that would help him get out of bed. You know, would it be useful to write it down, or is this something you can remember? He thought he could remember it. Okay, we'll give it a try and find out. You know, and he came back the next week On some days, he remembered this, ran it through his head, got out of bed, and it did indeed turn out better. On other days, he didn't bother, and he rolled over and went back to sleep and had a worse day. Hey, this is perfect. You know, we can compare the two approaches. And it sounds like he's got a choice. If he wants to have a day that sucks, he can roll over and go back to sleep. And if he wants to have a day that doesn't suck, he needs to drag his butt out of bed even though he doesn't feel like it at first. And, you know, his reaction was as though this is something brilliant. Because up to this point, he hasn't been very good at thinking things through step by step and noticing what the results are and learning from them and taking that into account in making choices. And also, he hasn't had a very useful strategy for getting himself to do what he wants to do. If you think about it, when he was a kid growing up, how did parents and teachers get him to do stuff they wanted him to do? They bossed him around. They yelled at him. They threatened him. They punished him. And when that's your experience, what do you learn from it? You learn, if I want to get somebody to do something, the way to do it is to boss them around, yell at them, threaten them, punish them. Suppose I want to get myself to do something. How do I do that? I boss myself around. I threaten myself. I yell at myself. I punish myself. If that strategy works for me, no problem. However, is Rex somebody where this strategy works? No, parents and teachers didn't have a whole lot of luck getting him to do stuff. Actually, one interesting bit of his history I forgot to mention in his history, his father was a physician. But his father was a physician for the mob. I didn't realize the mob in Cleveland had their own medical corps. But back in the day, they did. Yeah. His dad was a physician for the mob and had a completely mob-based practice. Very interesting city.
Mm-hmm. The video excerpt by Miller, was that a motivational interview?
Yeah.
It sounded very much like guided discovery.
Guided discovery is a big part of motivational interviewing. That Miller and company sort of came at it from a different direction. They came at it from all the research on the change process and generating motivation for change and so on. But they also are cognitive behavioral. And the approach they resolve is very compatible with guided discovery. And they don't particularly label motivational interview as interviewing as cognitive behavioral, but it really is. You know, part of it is, since they were promulgating this to the substance abuse field, if they had said, we've got a cognitive behavioral approach to generating motivation for change, they would have had two battles to fight. You know, both fighting on behalf of CBT and fighting on behalf of motivational interviewing. They made their job simpler by just saying, hey, we have an approach to generating motivation for change that works. Here's how you do it. And they sidestepped the question of labeling it cognitive behavioral or not. And so starting off with a concrete problem-solving approach gives us a great chance to work on the skills involved in looking realistically at the situation, considering alternatives, you know, predicting consequences, taking those into account, and choosing what option to exercise, putting it into practice, learning from the results, which helps the person get better at a bunch of the skills they're going to need in order to accomplish their goals. And so it's real useful on that level. It also has a good chance of having some benefits pretty early on. And since this is a population that's not big fans of working persistently towards goals because they don't expect it to pay off, it's real handy if you can get some noticeable improvement early on. That does a lot for motivation for change and for persisting in treatment. And one of the, you know, sort of next round of challenges is getting the person to persist in treatment, because left to themselves, their tendency is to drop out as soon as they accomplish that first goal. You know, with my kid who's appearing in juvenile court, you know, she gets you know, out of through her court appearance without being judged incorrigible, you know, left to herself, she would have been gone. You know, since she got dragged back to me, I had the chance to help her think through, oh yeah, there are other things that are worth working on. You know, with Rex, great. We help him come up with a strategy for getting his butt out of bed and having his days go better. And my next challenge is helping him register that there's other stuff worth working on. And if I don't do that right away, he's going to say, thanks, Doc, I'm out of here, and he's going to be gone. And that's obviously going to limit what we can accomplish.
But how do you do that if someone, like what you said, they accomplish their first goal, then they're mm-hmm. like, whoa, that's great. Then I had very persistent depression.
And there are a couple of different good options that work well in combination. First of all, when we're initially discussing goals to work towards, if I can identify more than one goal, then I've already know some other goals worth working towards. I may well need to help the client register, oh yeah, there are other things I wanted to accomplish. I can't just rely on them noticing that on their own. But when we're initially discussing goals for therapy, if I can, I'm going to identify more than one meaningful goal to work towards. And then as soon as we're getting into the vicinity of noticeable headway on the first goal, I'm going to mention, oh yeah, and there's other stuff you wanted to accomplish. You know, would this approach apply with some of these other things you wanted? So that we're not just working on one goal and then needing to start from scratch. Well, I'll already be thinking, yes, this works great for getting my butt out of bed. Would this apply on some of the other things I want? And I may be like, you know, we don't have time for today, but that's something we're going to want to get to in the near future. And so that, you know, has at least a shot at maintaining some motivation rather than we accomplish one goal, grind to a halt, and need to get rolling again. I'm also going to want to keep my ears open and notice signs that the person's starting to act like they're done and hopefully address that with them, you know, before they decide to not show up. And also, it's going to depend some on whether reality cooperates or not. You know, with Rex, I put in about 10 sessions working with him on the problem-solving approach to dealing with his medical complaints and waking up feeling lousy. And we worked on some stress management techniques because that was another of his priorities. And we were about to get rolling on resolving his issues around dealing with his buddy when he heard through the grapevine that his buddy had offended some characters in Vegas and they put out a contract on the guy. And poof went his dilemma. He no longer has to off the bastard. Somebody else is handling it. So poof went that source of stress and he dropped out of treatment at that point. Okay, I'm not omnipotent. We accomplished a lot of useful stuff. There was a good chance of it persisting. We didn't accomplish as much as we could have if we stayed engaged for longer. And sometimes life events have a big impact there. You know, with Luann, I ended up seeing her for a much longer time and accomplishing a lot more, partly because reality cooperated. She got off on the felonious assault charge. Poof goes her depression. But then her boyfriend was beating her up, and we were working on that. And then one of her kids got pregnant, you know, and we were working on that. And then, you know, a group of kids tried to rape one of her other daughters, and we were working on that. You know, and on the one hand, having a chaotic, multi-problem life gives us a heck of a lot to work on. On the other hand, it happened to give her persistent motivation for working in therapy, and made it, you know, possible for us to accomplish a lot more. There were also some gaps in my working with her. When we got to the point where things were going okay day to day, her motivation for working on stuff fizzled, and she took a break from therapy and then came back when the next, you know, piece hit the fan. And the problem-solving approach can work well with simple, concrete stuff like, you know, I wake up feeling lousy with Rex. It can also work with much more heavy-duty situations. You know, one day, you know, Luann was cranking along through life, And she got started thinking about her problems with her abusive boyfriend and got depressed, which had her doing more negative thinking about, you know, her other relationships with men. And she ended up thinking, you know, men, who needs them? Men have raped me. Men have attempted to kill me. Men have attempted to rule my life. And she became more and more angry and ended up thinking, my life is ruined. It's always fucking men. I want to ruin a couple of lives too. And she had vivid fantasies of killing two previous boyfriends. And fortunately, she dictated this all into a recorder and came in and talked to me about it rather than just going ahead on it. And this gave us a good chance to acknowledge and validate the feelings and then think through in what ways would be going after her exes be a good move. It would feel good. It would feel gratifying. She'd feel like she was getting even. And what are the downsides? What are the drawbacks? You know, and again, it's tempting to focus on, you know, oh my God, you'll get caught and you'll be in big trouble. But focusing on the likelihood of getting caught and the consequences of getting caught doesn't work as well as a source of motivation with this population as you'd expect. You know, that's something we want to touch on. But what I want to think more about is, how is it not to her advantage in terms of what's important to her? One of the things that was important to her is she wanted to be there for her kids, because that wasn't something she never had from her mom. Grandma raised her, mom did it. And if I go after my exes, how does that fit with wanting to be there for my kids? You know, there is some degree of risk of getting caught and ending up in big trouble, and if I'm in jail, that puts me in a much worse position to be the kind of parent I want to be. This puts me in a much worse position to look out for my kids and take care of them. You know, it puts me in a much worse position to let my kids know that I care about them. And we could look at what other options are there. What else could one do? And in this case, you know, she ended up concluding that there's a little guy didn't start, I can leave these idiots alone. They're not messing up my life anymore. And if I want my life to be less effed up, I could see about getting my act together and improving my life, rather than putting my energy into going after the people who've messed up my life, which would mess my life up more, not less. And, you know, she did not end up killing anybody, and she credits cognitive therapy with that. I don't know. I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't talked to me. Her history leads me to believe that there would have been some degree of risk of her going forth and attempting violence. And, you know, one of the things we're probably going to need to work on in the process of making better choices and following through on them is improving impulse control, which we talked about with borderline personality disorder. I use the same approach. It works the same way. So I won't discuss it again today. Now, as we work on the problem-solving approach, we're going to be, first of all, starting off with concrete situations where we're looking at the concrete, tangible consequences. But as we do that, as we start exploring different options and what's likely to work best, we're going to start running into situations where, in order to figure out which course of action is most promising, I need to anticipate how others are going to respond. Which means getting better at considering their point of view, looking at it from their point of view, anticipating how they're going to react. Which end up being real valuable skills. You know, if I'm mad at my boss because my boss wants me to work on Saturday and I worked last Saturday and this seems terribly unfair, and my impulse is to tell off the SOB. Okay, we can validate the feelings, and then we can look at, okay, one option is to tell off the SOB. What do you think? How will he react if you do that? You know, what do you think he'll think? What do you think he'll feel? What do you think he'll do? And often, it's amazing how off-target these individuals are. Oh! You know, piece of cake, fell back down and I won't have to work Saturday. You know, if the client's estimate seems to me to be grossly unrealistic, you know, do I want to say, no, you're wrong about that? That doesn't work very well. I don't know the boss. You know, what works much better is examining the evidence. What convinces you that he'll back down and you won't have to work Saturday? You know, have you ever tried this before? If so, how did the boss react? Have you tried this with other bosses before? How did they react? Oh, that's how you ended up out of work the last half dozen times. Gee, from what you're telling me, it sounds like your experience is when you storm in and tell the boss off, that generally gets you fired. That's one way to not have to work on Saturday. You know, do you want to lose the job in order to not have to work on Saturday? You know, if the person hasn't tried this out in their own life, you know, have other people gone in and told off the boss? How did the boss react to that, etc.? And once we've highlighted some of the drawbacks to telling off the boss as a way to deal with this, what other options are there? Have you dealt with this sort of situation in other ways in the past? You know, if so, we could look at how those options pan out. How do other people at work handle this? You know, would you be interested in hearing some ideas that I've heard about from other people I've worked with? And when I want to propose a strategy, I don't present it as, here's what I think you should do. Because that gets into some added issues that get in the way. You know, it's easy for it to feel like I'm telling them what they should do, which is going to trigger their impulse to push back. If I frame it as, some other people have said they tried such and so, how's that sound to you? How do you think your boss would react to that? You know, and if we can take, when they've got an estimate that sounds realistic, oh, if I talk to him calmly and reasonably, he reacts okay to that. Oh, that sounds promising. How would you put that into practice in real life? But if they come up with something that sounds to be unrealistic, examining the evidence is a good way to help them register, oh, this isn't such a good idea after all. And then we can look at more promising alternatives. And not only are we doing more effective problem solving, but this gets a chance for us to get into what I refer to as empathy induction. You know, working on developing the empathy skills. And this is at the top of page 5. And generally pretty simple questions. You know, how do you think he would react? You know, how would it feel to you if somebody stormed into your office and told you, hell no, I'm not working on Saturday, etc. And then, how can you take this into account? How can we test this out? How can we apply it? And it often turns out easier than you'd expect for people to get better at considering the other person's point of view and taking it into account. Now, if you do it just that far, gee, that sounds like, aren't I just making them more effective sociopaths? Isn't this bad for society? But actually, one interesting thing that happens is, as I get better at grasping the other person's point of view, as it starts to sink in that if I insult you, it feels much the same way as if you insult me, I'm likely to end up being less free about doing terrible things to others, not because I want to become a Boy Scout, not because I want to become a good person, but because I have a more realistic grasp of the impact I have on others. And also because I'm getting better at recognizing how it's to my disadvantage to harm people, to piss people off, etc. And how it's to my advantage to deal with people in ways that they can live with. You know, if I want to keep the job, it's to my advantage to not piss off the boss. You know, and, you know, for a lot of people, that's sort of a new concept. Questions, comments? Now, and so, you know, if we can keep the person engaged in therapy long enough, we can actually accomplish quite a bit. Good example with Luann, you know, between, you know, my actively working to keep her engaged and reality helping with that, you know, I kept her in therapy a good while and accomplished quite a bit. For example, after I'd been working with her, I forget, 9 months or so, she'd gotten out of the relationship with an abusive boyfriend. She'd met somebody who actually seemed promising and had a, you know, decent relationship, and he treated her nicely and they could work stuff out and so on. And then she found out that he hadn't actually gotten around to divorcing his ex-wife. And her immediate reaction was to feel betrayed and be ready to lash out physically and then stomp out. And it dawned on her, wait a minute, this is the sort of shit I've done too. And she could look at it from his point of view and realize that this wasn't in, you know, personal. This was his just not wanting to face stuff and deal with it. And she was able to come in and talk about it semi-reasonably and then drag him in for a few couple sessions and, you know, let him know in no uncertain terms that this was not okay and he should not pull this sort of shit. And he should have let her know long ago, and that he needed to actually get around to divorcing his ex-wife. But they made it through it and continued working out a fairly decent relationship. Yeah. And, you know, she ended up giving Black Pride lectures to the kids on her school bus. I'm not making this up, she actually joined the Bible study group. But what impressed me, you know, she was tired of driving the damn bus. And there was some construction going on near her house, and she noticed that a food truck showed up at lunchtime to the construction site to sell lunch to the workers, and her cooking was a hell of a lot better than the crap on the food truck. So she decided she was going to do a food truck of her own and sell good food to construction workers and make lots of money. And then she discovered there's such a thing as a health department that has opinions as to how you need to go about this. And she actually paused and looked into what she would have to do to get licensed. And then she decided that was more hassle than it was worth and decided to get a grant and go to Tri-C instead. Hmm. Okay, this is not antisocial behavior when you discover there's a health department out there. You know, and she was still had a fairly complex life with, you know, a whole variety of issues. But she was a lot better at problem solving. She was thinking ahead about the consequences. She was taking other people's feelings into account. And she was actually being a pretty reasonable, ordinary person. It still probably would not be a good idea to piss her off. I think she was stronger than I am. on the other hand, you know, she was able to be a strong, tough person without provoking others. And conducted herself in a way that worked pretty decent in her neighborhood and in her jobs. It's not half bad. If you make it all the way to working on relapse prevention, you know, in addition to all the usual stuff, one thing we want to pay attention to is the social pressures the client faces. Because, you know, with the crowd they've been hanging with, if they go get a job and actually succeed in holding down the job, there actually may be some pushback from their friends and associates. You know, I've had a number of clients, they get a job, they hold it down for several weeks, and then all their buddies show up with a case of beer while they're, you know, loading flats in Home Depot and try to talk them into, you know, going off to a party. You know, I can think of a number of times people made it through Lakeland Institute's 28-day program and their friends picked them up with a bottle of champagne to celebrate. You know, and one option, you know, particularly for the, you know, family members and so on, that I'm, you know, good option is let me break my relationship with bad influences off and replace them with better influences. That's a good option, and halfway house programs and so on can be real useful. For all the relationships I'm willing to break off, you know, for the relationships, you know, my siblings, you know, my extended family, my spouse, that I may not want to break off all those relationships, how do I deal with those pressures effectively? you know, with the guy on the video. If visiting his brother exposes him to lots of heavy smoking and has a risk of relapse, my bet is we could think that through and come up with a plan for how to handle that situation without going back to smoking. And if we don't sit down and think that through explicitly, you know, he's going to be at a much higher risk of relapse. And one sort of situation that we want to anticipate when we're working on relapse prevention is, suppose the person goes forth trying to, you know, be a reasonable person doing reasonable stuff, and they're treated unfairly, they're discriminated against, they're taken advantage of. Basically, suppose they have experiences that fit with their old world view. If we don't address that proactively, there's a high risk of them bouncing back to, yeah, see, I was right, everybody's up for themselves, nobody's going to treat me fairly, there's no point to playing by the rules. You know, if we talk it through in advance, wait a minute, are we saying everybody is nice and kind and friendly? Are we saying everybody's going to treat them fairly and give them an even break? No, there's no shortage of people out there who are unreasonable, unfair, exploitive, etc. How do we want to deal with that? As soon as we realize that that's what this person is like, I might want to minimize my need to deal with them. You know, I might, you know, need to, you know, still be able to be tough when tough is needed. I may need to let the person know in no uncertain terms that they can't get away with giving me shit. You know, that it's important to remember that our goal isn't to make the person be nice. The goal is to help them be effective in their environment. You know, I was a good Boy Scout. That was not an effective strategy in the neighborhood I was growing up in. You know, I needed to learn to be tougher. It took me till 15 to learn that one. Finally, I punched one of the bullies who was picking on me. He punched me back and did much more damage to me than I did to him. But after that, they treated me with respect. Before that, a big part of why they picked on me was they couldn't understand why I didn't fight back. And that resulted in them picking on me more rather than less. Interesting trivia, one of my friends from high school got in touch with me on Facebook and we compared notes, and it turns out the bullies on the school bus that picked on both of us, one of them became a priest and the other became an orthodontist. Strange world we live in. Questions, comments, reactions? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break.